Hello, this is Ethan Nadelman, Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, and I'm welcoming to you today to the latest in our series of web chats on the Drug Policy Alliance webpage. Today, I'm delighted to have two guests. One is Angel Raich, whose name and picture has been much in the media and the newspapers in the last few days because of the Supreme Court decision on Monday. And the other guest is Dan Abrahamson, who's been the Director of Legal Affairs for the Drug Policy Alliance and before that the Linda Smith Center for the last 8 years and has been very deeply involved in the medical marijuana issue for many years. So, Dan, Angel, welcome on this today's web chat show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay, great. Well, listen, I should also tell our listeners that both of them have been going around the clock for the last couple of days, so they're a bit tired and exhausted. But, I mean, Angel, you've really been through the ringer over the last few days. Just tell us, I mean, you know, here it is, the Supreme Court comes down. I mean, we were all, you know, we couldn't really, none of us had high hopes that the Supreme Court would come down in our direction, but we thought there was a possibility. But just tell us, what's it been like for you the last couple of days?
It's really been a real big whirlwind, as you might imagine. I actually was lucky enough to be up on the day the decision came in. I'd already had my shower and everything, and I was actually sitting in front of my husband's desk at home medicating when I leaned back in my chair and said, you know, when the day the decision comes in, I think I would like to have an extra 10 or 15 minutes because I think I would like to have an extra couple minutes to medicate. And as soon as I said that, my phone rang. So it's been incredible. Everybody, I've had a great amount of support, even here on the local level with some of the sheriffs and stuff. So, you know, I think that that's good. I think that the way that the decision came down, even though we did not win, I think that it is like a win because we've really done a lot as far as changing some of the public opinion about this issue. And even some of the live radio shows that I've been on across the country, some of which were conservative, we got a very warm response to them and no negative comments.
You know, Angel, I'm curious, can they find anybody to debate you on this issue?
They haven't done a very good job of getting anybody.
Yeah, I mean, my experience has been that typically, you know, nobody wants to come out and debate this issue. They want to issue press statements or, you know, hurl rocks across the way, but they don't really want to go face-to-face, and especially when it's a patient or a doctor. That is just too humiliating on their side to try to, you know, go head-to-head.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. They actually hide behind the phone and do that and try to say that cocaine, you know, smoking cocaine is the same as smoking marijuana. And that is just so, I just don't seem to understand where they get that logic. And I've really tried to understand them a little bit better because I think that if I can try to understand them a little bit better, that maybe I can try to convince them to maybe understand where we're coming from a little bit better. But, you know, I was on a show yesterday with Faye, I can't remember her last name, from Drug Free America Foundation.
Oh, Calvina Faye.
Yes, yes.
Yes, yeah.
And
she's a piece of work.
Yes, and, you know, it was so funny. She didn't do a very good job of coming up against me. I tried really hard to take her arguments away from her in advance. So, I don't know. You know, they still to this date have not come to the table, and they definitely have not come on any talk shows with me.
Yeah. Now, Dan, I wonder, you know, you've been working on this issue. I mean, you played a key role even going back to 1997. You just come on board at the Linda Smith Center, and we just won Prop 215, the Medical Marijuana Initiative in California. And it's, you know, around Christmas time, 96. And Barry McCaffrey, then the drug czar, and Donna Shalhoub and others stand up and say that they're going to go after the doctors and the patients, and you came up with a fairly interesting angle that you pursued with the ACLU, and that then eventually took through the courts. Why don't you describe that that evolution, and then maybe talk about the connections to this case that's been happening and some of the others?
Absolutely. Well, when California passed Prop 215 in 1996. The federal government was outraged that all of a sudden an entire state, especially one as large as California, could legalize medical marijuana for their citizens. And so, you know, top government lawyers got around a table in Washington, D.C. and said, is there any way that we can attack California's medical marijuana law and knock it off the books? And the answer that quickly became clear to them was they couldn't. They could not attack the law directly because the state had the state's rights to pass such a law. And so they tried to come up with the next best thing that they could think of to neutralize the law, which was to attack the physicians in California. And they said if physicians actually recommend marijuana to their patients, as a state law allowed, the federal government would go after those physicians using the Federal Controlled Substances Act. And so we went into federal court on behalf of the California's physicians and said that physicians have a First Amendment free speech right to recommend marijuana to their patients, and that's a constitutional right that the federal government couldn't take away from them. Mm-hmm. And over a series of 5 or 6 years, every federal judge that listened to that argument agreed with us, agreed with the doctors, agreed with the voters of California, and prevented, the federal courts prevented the federal government from beating up on doctors. And as a result, we have over 100,000 people in California with medical recommendations for marijuana because doctors are free to recommend it.
Now, Dan, that, I guess, remains as sort of the one major victory in the federal courts, that's where the Supreme Court has not decided to come down the other way. Is
that's
right?
And the decision on Monday by the Supreme Court does not touch that other decision, the First Amendment decision, whatsoever.
So notwithstanding the decision on Monday, patients and doctors are still free to talk about this. Now, what do you think are going to be the other implications? I mean, you know, you and I and Angel and others have been out there basically saying that with this case, we really had just about nothing to lose from a legal perspective and everything to gain if the courts had ruled in our favor. But as it is, all they essentially did was to reaffirm the status quo. I mean, is that basically the right perspective?
That's exactly right. I think Monday's decision put us back on the legal playing field that we always felt we were on and always felt that we would have to play on. Namely, states could pass very protective laws that provided patients with lots of state law protections to use, grow, obtain medical marijuana, while at the same time the feds could enforce federal law against the patients if they chose to do so. And so that's the playing ground we always expected to be on. That's the playing ground we are on now. And really the challenge from here and out is to convince local and state politicians that nothing has changed and that they should continue to advocate on behalf of the patients in their states by passing more protective laws.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I would actually just like to add to that because prior to the filing of my case, if everybody remembers, the federal government was already in the state of California raiding and locking up sick and disabled and dying Americans. So, you know, the real question is the federal government going to continue to waste taxpayers' dollars and coming into a state where medical cannabis is legal and locking up sick people? That's the real question. Or are they going to start putting the money into Homeland Security and other domestic issues?
Right, and as Andrew Raich says that, if you were in California this morning, the top story in the newspapers was that an Al-Qaeda cell was found in Northern California, raided by federal officials. And so I'm hoping that the feds keep their eyes on Al-Qaeda and keep them off of Angel Raich.
Yeah, because we all remember what happened just a few years back when, you know, FBI agents would come across somebody being involved in potential terrorism, and they were told, listen, we're focused on drugs, whether it was people going to flight schools in Arizona or coming across the Canadian border, what have you. But Dan, I think you told me, or I saw an email, that you had an interesting debate with some DEA official who was somewhat explicit about what their priorities are right now.
This is one of the most impressive and surprising things that have come out of the last 2 days of media onslaught on the medical marijuana issues. I think the feds have been inundated with bad press about how mean-spirited the DEA in particular is and wanting to focus their energies on attacking patients. And I think the hundreds of media calls that the DEA has received and the bad press and the bad columns that have been published in newspapers that are, you know, really disparaging the Supreme Court's decision and supporting patients has gotten to the DEA. And so last night on National Public Radio, a senior DEA official said, for the first time that I'm aware of, that the DEA has no intention of targeting individual patients and that instead the DEA really wants to focus on taking down the big drug cartels. And that was, I think, very good and heartening news for everyone in this movement.
Yes, you know, and actually in the last couple of days here locally in the Bay Area, they actually have been having similar stuff over the TV where John Walters will go in and say that they're going to continue to prosecute people for using medical marijuana, medical cannabis. And then they, interviewed a local federal agent. And the agent basically said that they weren't going to go after individual patients, that they were going to go after, you know, the people that were selling them the cannabis. So You know, I think that it's interesting to see because, I mean, even just today I had a meeting with our local sheriff who in the past has been very conservative and very, I'll call the feds on you, okay? And yesterday in the supervisor's chambers in front of a whole audience in front of TV cameras, he specifically said that he would not do that. So, you know, and he was willing to meet with me today. So I think that we're seeing some of the people that were really opposed to us now saying, well, we really need to, you know, push Congress to changing the laws to do something about this.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's break these issues out right now. Let's talk, first of all, just a little more insight into the Supreme Court case. And let's talk about the action in Congress and then at the states, and then let's focus specifically on the Bay Area. So first, Dan, I think almost nobody predicted the way that the Supreme Court was going to break out with Rehnquist and Clarence Thomas joining Sandra O'Connor on the side of, basically on Angel's side, and the reportedly liberal justices joining with Scalia and Kennedy on the other side. And perhaps can you just give your best explanation for that, please?
Well, the best explanation starts with the realization that this case was not just about medical marijuana. It was about a larger debate occurring within the court about the role of the federal government, federal powers, and states' rights, which is a discussion and debate that's been occurring in this court for some years now. And so the breakdown of the justices is partly explained by their aversion to drugs and marijuana. I think that principally explains why Justice Scalia jettisoned his principles of states' rights and joined the majority in this case. And it's partly explained by the justices' other jurisprudence regarding states' rights, which I think explains Justice Stevens and the other people who joined him trying to keep states' rights issues at bay, and explains certainly Justice O'Connor's and Justice Thomas's and Chief Justice Rehnquist's opinions in the dissent. And so I think what we see in the dissenting opinions is a strong argument for states' rights and limited federal powers, and in the majority, just the opposite.
I should say it's interesting to see even the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, I think it was today, coming out and basically criticizing Scalia and the others for jettisoning their principles. I mean, the Wall Street Journal editorial page has been, together with the New York Post, perhaps two of the most egregious proponents of the drug war in America. And yet here they're saying states' rights should have trumped everything.
You know,
right.
I just want to just add to that a little bit. You know, something that a lot of people aren't also thinking about is that Rehnquist helped write the Controlled Substance Act. And so the way I see this decision also is that, you know, here is a man that is also very, very sick, as everybody is well aware of that. But here's a man that wrote this Controlled Substance Act that is basically now keeping patients from medicine. And I think that, you know, what he said in his dissent was very clear that, hey, he made a mistake by, you know, with the Controlled Substance Act. Maybe they should have allowed medical use in that. And so that's one of the things that I would like for people to really think about, too, is that, you know, we need more people like Rehnquist to change their mind on that. And I hope that this decision is doing that. And I think that even Stevens himself, you know, even though he was against what we were doing or, you know, really not siding for us, but he also specifically said in there that, you know, that there looked like there was a medical use of medical marijuana. So, you know, I think that the writing is on the wall, that it's just, you know, I'm really glad to see that he gave us that, and I'm glad to see that even though he didn't vote for us, he's pointing at Congress to say, you know, hey, you need to do something. You need to change this. And, you know, if the federal government's not going to allow us to research, then it's, you know, Congress that needs to tell the federal government that you need to allow more research and we need to change this to a different schedule.
Yeah. Well, you know, it also seems in a way that what happened was that the more liberal justices who opposed the states' rights claims, that what they did was they saw an opportunity here to put the brakes on the expansion of states' rights by sticking to their guns on this case, by ignoring or at least downplaying the concerns of you, Angel, and other patients, and figuring that they could peel off somebody like Scalia, who cared more about the drug war than he cared about states' rights. I mean, Dan, would that be, you think, an accurate interpretation?
I think it is an accurate interpretation that they used Angel Reich's case to narrow precedent that they didn't like in support of states' rights, and so it really furthered their agenda to put a brakes, as you said, to put a brakes on the states' rights agenda.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing in a broader, I mean, just to get away from the medical marijuana issue for a second, because it's interesting. So for so long, the whole issue of states' rights was associated with racists in the South who wanted to ignore federal civil rights laws. And so traditionally, you know, it was among the reasons why conservatives sometimes linked up with states' rights and liberals were hostile. But I sometimes wonder that now in 2005, where the federal government is very much in the hands not just of the Republican Party or of conservatives, but really in the hands of the reactionary wing of this party. And it's a wing that no longer talks about restrained powers, which is much more interested in building much more of a powerful federal police presence and a powerful federal presence. One would think that liberals would be increasingly inclined or sympathetic to some of the states' rights arguments. I mean, it's really the states that appear to be the quote-unquote laboratories of democracy in terms of innovative policies with respect to drug policy and much more. I don't know, Dan, I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, you are seeing in this historical moment an increasing support of states' rights among who you consider traditional liberals. And I think there's another case that that's pending in the Supreme Court that's going to be argued this fall that's going to re-raise many of these issues once again and be a lightning rod for this debate, and that concerns the Oregon state statute allowing physician-assisted suicide that the federal government does not want to be on the books, but the citizens of Oregon deeply believe in, and the court's going to hear the challenge of whether Oregon has states' rights to allow and pass a law that allows physician-assisted suicide over and against the moral objections of a conservative White House.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take a little break right here. This is Ethan Nadelman. I'm Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. For those of you who tuned in recently, I'm talking with Angel Reich, who was the point person on the Supreme Court decision on Monday, as well as with Dan Abrahamson, the longtime Legal Affairs Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Drug Policy Alliance is a membership organization. We depend upon you both to take action as well as to support our efforts and to join the 30,000 members of DPA. So if you're not yet a member of the Drug Policy Alliance, please do hit that join button on the website and please join us. And please also consider coming to the International Conference on Drug Policy Reform, which DPA is organizing, Drug Policy Alliance is organizing and hosting with a range of other organizations in Long Beach, California, November 10th to 12th. That'll be the leading gathering in the United States of people who believe the war on drugs is doing more harm than good, and it'll be the most remarkable 3-day crash course in drug policy issues that anybody has ever been to. Now, let's turn to the issue of Congress. There is this amendment, the Hinchey-Rohrabacher Amendment, you know, introduced 2 years ago, last year, and this year by Maurice Hinchey, a liberal New York congressman, and Dana Rohrabacher, the conservative Southern California Republican congressman. This amendment would basically prohibit the Justice Department from spending a penny to go after medical marijuana in the 10 states that have made it legal under state law. Now, in the past couple of years, 70% of all voting Democrats have embraced this, but unfortunately only about 15 Republicans. You know, the Drug Policy Alliance, as well as a Marijuana Policy Project and Americans for Safe Access and a Normal and a range of other organizations have worked intensively on this issue. We were successful in getting the support of most of the Democratic leadership in the House, but we've really struggled to get Republicans on board. Now, Angel, you said you're going to be going to Washington fairly soon to work on this. Maybe tell us a little more about that.
Yes, I'm actually Monday. I'm heading out of the Bay Area, and I'm flying to Washington, D.C. On Tuesday, the Hinchey-Rohrabacher Amendment will be on the House floor. So I will actually be trying to meet with some of the congressmen that are opposed to this amendment. And I'm also going to be doing a lot of press work around it. So I think it's very important to do what we can to get Congress to pass this. So, you know, even though the Supreme Court has ruled against this, at least the states in the United States that do support medical cannabis, you know, the patients will be protected.
Okay. Now, I should say that for those of you listening right now, you can go right over to the front page of the Drug Policy Alliance website, that action alert there next to the case about Rach v. Ashcroft, and just push right there, and you'll be able to contact your congressman try to help and hopefully influence that. I think there's also an alert from Marijuana Policy Project out today and probably one going out at the beginning of next week from Drug Policy Alliance. Please consider forwarding those to everybody you know so that we can line up as many people as possible and try to sway some votes on this thing. Now, Dan, if in point of fact, it's still a long shot that we can win the Hinchey-Rohrabacher Amendment, but if in fact we did, what would be the implications of that?
Two implications. First of all, patients in those states with medical marijuana laws could take a deep sigh of relief that they no longer have to fear federal agents busting down their doors in the middle of the night to take their marijuana away from them, because the feds, again, would be prevented from going after patients in those states. So it would be a great benefit to the hundreds of thousands of patients in those states. Second, it would send an important message to other states where medical marijuana legislation is being considered, that they have a green light to go ahead and pass legislation that is protective of patients without worrying about federal government interference. And so I think it really would send a good political message for other states as well.
Now, what other courses of action might there be with the feds? I mean, I know I saw some, there was a very interesting op-ed piece by Sally Satel in today's New York Times. She's been very unpredictable on this issue. She's oftentimes written some terrible things supporting the drug war, but in today's New York Times, she actually came out saying it's time for the federal government to start playing a more supportive role. And she focused especially on an issue which Rick Doblin and MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, has been involved in, which is trying to break the federal monopoly on marijuana for research purposes. I wonder if either of you would like to comment on that whole situation.
Sure, I'll take a stab at it first, which is, you know, one of the ironies of the drug war in the last 20 years is the federal government has gone to great lengths to stop any research from being undertaken regarding medical marijuana. And then the federal government goes and points to the lack of research proving that medical marijuana is effective. And really, one of the next steps that should be taken if we've got a long-term goal of persuading Congress to reschedule marijuana is to persuade Congress to fund medical marijuana studies to make it easier for researchers to obtain the good quality marijuana for the research subjects and for these studies to take place. And that's what Sally Satel's article says, is let's lift that roadblock that has been there for too long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that a lot of people don't seem to understand, too, because I hear this quite often, is they say that there isn't any research. Well, everybody knows that there is some research. It's just not enough research. And so I think that, you know, that's one thing that both sides agree on, is that there needs to be research. And I think that we definitely need to continue to do whatever method we need to do, and I really hope that MAP succeeds on their case regarding that, because I think it's very important that we have good quality medicine, and I think that, you know, we really won't know what all the individual components of cannabis, which ones help which elements, until we, you know, do that kind of research. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's really important.
Now, the other issue that keeps popping out is how to get somebody in the federal government to reschedule. I mean, right back in the 1980s, you had a case, I think it was Normal, that pursued it for many years, that sought to get marijuana rescheduled from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2. And you had the DEA's administrative law judge, Francis Young, who held years of hearings and concluded that, in point of fact, based upon the evidence, marijuana should be rescheduled to Schedule 2. In fact, he described marijuana as perhaps the least dangerous psychoactive substance known in human history. Now, in that case, the DEA chief had the legal authority to overrule that recommendation, and he did so. Now, I know there's been efforts in Congress. I think there's this petition that John Getman has been promoting with respect to, I believe it's HHS. I mean, there are bills in Congress. Angel, Dan, anything you want to offer about all those possibilities?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things is that also is out, based out of, on the East Coast, too. I wonder if we do a similar thing. I know that a few people out here have gotten involved in that kind of a lawsuit, but maybe one of the avenues that we should do is take some of the people that were literally affected here in the Ninth Circuit and file a lawsuit similar to it out here in the Ninth Circuit, where we know we have a little bit better opportunity to hopefully make some better ground. But, I mean, outside of just continuing to lobby, you know, the federal government won't even really meet with us. So until the federal government comes to the table with us and it finally realizes that, you know, we need good policy. You know, it's not just a matter of making it accessible to patients. It's also about having good policy surrounding that. And I think that, you know, that's something that up to this point they have not been willing to even look at.
Mm-hmm. Dan?
Well, there are, you know, a lot of pressure points that can be pushed and I think should be pushed in the larger effort to get the laws on marijuana, medical marijuana, changed. And certainly the research angle and the rescheduling angle are important pressure points that need to be pushed. At the same time, I think it's also important to realize that this is an administration that does not take seriously good science. They don't even believe in the greenhouse effect and are willing to scrap the Kyoto protocols along those lines. And so we should not, you know, fool ourselves into believing that when we present federal officials with good science and the truth about medical marijuana, that they're going to listen. In the end, it's a political game. It's a political decision decided at political levels within the administration of whether to reschedule or not. And so we have to be pushing all the other buttons as well to change the political climate over this issue.
Yeah. You know, I'm looking at some of the questions which have come through from folks, and a lot of them ask, you know, what can they do to change, and would it have made any difference if the Democrats were in charge, you know, if Kerry were in the White House or the Democrats, you know, had the either House of Congress? And I think the answer, although it would not have affected the court at this time, is that the answer is almost certainly yes, that if you look at the Hinchey-Rohrabacher Amendment, and you look at the fact that 70% of voting Democrats approved of this amendment, whereas only 15 Republicans, it does appear to make a real difference. It would make a difference to have, you know, John Conyers as opposed to James Sensenbrenner as chair of the House Judiciary Committee, or to have Pat Leahy as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. You know, one thing we even found was that with the Republicans in the House, many of them privately said that they would like to vote in favor of this Hinchey-Rohrabacher Amendment, but felt that there was too much pressure from the White House to stay in line on this. So, I mean, obviously, when people are asking what they can be doing, a key answer really is putting the pressure as much as possible on your members of Congress. Let them know that you care about this issue. You know, go to the, you know, on the DPA website, make the most of the opportunities there to fax and to write and to call your members of Congress. But what I'd like to do right now is switch over to the question and the issue of the states, right? I mean, this is there are right now bills being proposed in probably 10 or 15 state legislatures, either earlier this year, later this year, or right now, to legalize marijuana for medical purposes. And I think, as most of our listeners know, there's already about 10 states that are considered medical marijuana states: California, Alaska, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Nevada, Maine, and Montana, all of which enacted medical marijuana through the initiative process, and then Hawaii and Vermont, which did it through the legislative process, and meanwhile, a whole range of other states that are working on this right now. I mean, Drug Policy Alliance has been working in New Mexico and New Jersey, Connecticut, Alabama, and Wisconsin, and I know that Marijuana Policy Project has been involved in Rhode Island and in New York and in Illinois and a number of other states as well. I know that the Drug Policy Forum of Massachusetts was just involved in hearings there in the last couple of days. And the question really is, what's the impact on all of these efforts? Now, I have some thoughts about that, but let me throw this out to the two of you first.
Well, you know, I think that we can still do this. I think that it's just going to be a little bit more difficult. Am I correct, or did Rhode Island just pass theirs just since the decision came in?
That's right.
Correct?
There's a comment here from Tom Angel at SSDP, and he points out that the Rhode Island Senate just approved the medical marijuana measure 34-2 the day after the Supreme Court's decision. So clearly the message that the Supreme Court case has no impact upon what the states does is reaching home to a lot of people. And, you know, if anything, one would hope that the Rhode Island member, the legislators actually saw themselves as sending a message to the federal government with that. But I'll tell you something else, too. In the Connecticut state legislature, we're working with local activists. It's called The Better Way is the name of the drug policy reform organization in Connecticut. We got this bill through the Senate, which was the tougher house to get it through, just at the end of last week to legalize marijuana for medicinal purposes. And it was all set to move through the Connecticut Assembly yesterday or today. And because of the decision, it's created that little opportunity for some of our opponents to mobilize in resistance. I've been noticing the media messaging all around the country. Our people are trying very hard to put out the word that legislators in New Mexico and New York and New Jersey and Wisconsin and Alabama have the same power and the same ability and the same authority to legalize marijuana for medicinal purposes in their state as the legislators did in Vermont last year or in Hawaii 4 or 5 years ago or as the voters did in any of the states that did it by the initiative process. That's a key message that we're trying very, very, very hard to get through at this time.
And I think that one of the things that we really need to focus on, too, during this process is that, and a message that we need to continue to get out there is the fact that my decision did not affect state and local laws, because I think that that would really help us. And if we can also use Rhode Island as an example of how this can still be done, and if we need to, I've got a couple surgeries coming up, but, you know, I don't know when they're actually going to be on every ballot, but, you know, I'm willing to do whatever I can to also, you know, be a voice for those patients in those states if we need to do that. So, I think that we need to just continue to pass these legislations and continue to do polls to show so that we can show Congress that, look, you know, not only do more and more states continue to pass medical marijuana laws, but your constituents support it. And look, here's a poll to show that this percentage, you know, of your constituents support this. So it's safe for you now to come out and support us.
Now, Dan, you've been involved in helping draft a lot of these medical marijuana bills around the country. Is there anything that you would do differently as a result of the Supreme Court decision?
No, I would not. The laws that are already on the books of the 10 states you mentioned are good laws. They're different from one another. They address local concerns that each state has about medical marijuana and the illnesses that people suffer. But generally, there's nothing I would do different in light of the Raich decision other than stick to a basic template that includes the following elements. It includes physicians using their best medical judgment to recommend or approve marijuana to patients. It requires patients to be ill with a condition that is known to be treatable with medical marijuana. And it allows patients and their caregivers to cultivate enough marijuana and to use enough marijuana to address those illnesses. Those are sort of the three essential elements that any piece of legislation should have in it.
Yeah, well, I should tell our listeners that I know Drug Policy Alliance is very committed to continuing to push for more medical marijuana laws around the country. I know that Marijuana Policy Project is very much doing the same. So we see ourselves as very committed to this process, that even though federal law is what it is, that it's important to change the law at the state level. It's important to keep in mind that 99% of all law enforcement arrests are made by state and local authorities, not by the feds. It's important to keep in mind that the DEA, as Dan mentioned before, is already saying that it doesn't intend to go after patients, but only the larger providers. And it's important to keep in mind that the best way to ultimately sway congressional opinion in this area is to keep changing state laws and then bring those changes home to bear in the halls of Congress. That's part of the game plan.
Ethan, you had asked earlier, what is the importance of passing these state laws? And you just mentioned one of the key importances is that the more states that pass these types of laws, the more likely it is that Congress will take seriously the calls to change the medical marijuana laws at the federal level. A second importance that really can't be overlooked, and Angel is a stellar example of this, is that these state laws do have a real everyday practical impact on sick people. In states that have medical marijuana laws, lots of people can get relief that they really couldn't get otherwise but for those laws. And third, if Congress, for whatever reason, doesn't change the law, if more and more states pass these types of laws, there's an increasing chance that we can go back to the U.S. Supreme Court and say someday that a majority of these states in the United States protect medical marijuana. Federal law is so out of whack that this court should strike down those federal prohibitions on the grounds that the majority of the states think otherwise. And that's something we've seen the court do in recent years in the juvenile death penalty area, and also with respect to the death penalty in executing mentally retarded people. When enough states said, no, that's improper, the court acted and struck down the ability to do that.
Yeah. You know, I should say, Dan Angel, that when I was asked in many of these interviews in the last couple of days, well, I don't get it. I mean, what federal law is against it, so isn't that the final word? And one of the analogies I used was to the early 1930s in alcohol prohibition, when, you know, the 18th Amendment was enacted and went into force in 1919. We had national alcohol prohibition. But by the late 20s and early 30s, as more and more people had concluded that alcohol prohibition was a failure and even counterproductive, a number of states began to repeal their own alcohol prohibition laws. They began to remove state police authorities from enforcing alcohol prohibition laws, basically saying to the feds, if you want to keep enforcing this, then your Bureau of Alcohol Prohibition agents can do it, but we're not going to participate. And, of course, that ultimately contributed to the end of the 18th Amendment, the repeal through the 21st Amendment. I think it's very similar in this case. More and more states are opting out of the federal prohibition on marijuana, at least for medicinal purposes. And the more that do that, the more the message is going to go to Washington saying, you want to do this, you do it, but we're no longer playing ball with you. And because this is a states' rights argument as well, it means it crosses very much across partisan lines. And as Angel was pointing out before, too, there's also this element of compassion. There's the fact that, you know, whether one's a Rehnquist or whoever it is, one gets this angle sometimes from a very personal dimension.
Angel, yes, and I think that, you know, I think if anything has showed and spoke very loud and clear is that the personal stories through the media is what's really also getting the attention. And I think that that's also what's going to help change the minds of those who are opposed to us.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I'm looking at the states where we're working, and in Connecticut and Wisconsin and Alabama, I think in New Mexico as well, in every one of those cases, the lead Republican sponsor or co-sponsor of the medical marijuana legislation has a personal or familial experience either with cancer or MS, and that's what's driving them to move forward in this area. I mean, Angel, you were talking before about Montel Williams, I mean, who
yes.
turned out to be a fantastic advocate on this issue.
Yes, he is, and he's also very sick and a very warm-hearted person. And I think that as time goes on, as more of us talk out about this, I think that we can really do this. And I look forward to doing more with Montel because I think that, and one of the things that I've heard literally from reporters, from people in our community, people from the medical cannabis community, is that Montel and I seem to really be driving in a lot of media hits. And not only do we do that, but the way that the public looks at it, the way that the media looks at it, the way that the reporters look at it, is very significant to the way that the story gets out into the media. And so I think that that's very important. I think that the more we have people with, you know, within a position, it doesn't matter what position that it is in life. You know, Montel is fortunate. He has a TV talk show. You know, we all have our own little things. You know, we need more people like that. We need more politicians. We need more police. We need more council people. We need nurses, doctors, you know, cops. We need these people to come out on our behalf because we need that. And Montel is very sick and he has MS, and that's a very progressive, very serious progressive illness. And, you know, people that have MS, cannabis, I just want to say this on behalf of people that have MS, because MS, there's not a whole lot of research. And, you know, it depends on which doctor